So thanks for coming at what on the West Coast we think of as 7 a.m. To this panel. This panel is called Every Breath You Take. It's about identity, presence, attention, reputation, blah, 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 blah. I want to brief. We're going to try to cover a lot of ground, so I'm going to try to keep the pace rapid, I guess. My name is Christian Krumlish. I'm moderating the panel. I think we all put our first names on our placards because we're not last name kinds of people. To my left is Ted Nadeau, an old buddy of mine who's been coding since he was in diapers and has been involved in a lot of startups and is heavily involved in things related to the attention economy nowadays. Next to him is Mary Hodder, who's the founder of Dabble, which is a video search and discovery social network. Next to Mary is Kalia Hamlin, who is a superhero known as Identity Woman, and a leader in the Identity Commons chaotic entity thing. And at the end of the line is George Kelly, who is a journalist and a blog vivant. So let's start. First of all, I think all this social network stuff and these ideas about the technology and who's online and what your presence is and all where your attention is going, we can often get wrapped up a lot in the implementation issues and the questions of technology and bits on the wire and stuff like that. And I wanted to remind everybody that it's people with this slide from Soylent Green. Next, I, of course, have to plug my 2-3-year-old book, The Power of Many, mainly because when I was writing it, as often happens when you're writing a book, near the end of the book, you get so obsessed with your topic that you start having all kinds of ideas that don't fit inside the book anymore. And so for me, what I started thinking about after writing a book about social networking was a lot of stuff about presence, about how we project ourselves online and how we represent our identities in an online space. And so what I found was that I had a third of a new book by the time I'd finished that one. That new book hasn't come out yet. It's basically a big, long outline right now. And so my scam was to put together this panel, take notes on what the other people say, and get a little bit more of my book written. Another thing that I was thinking about when I was writing that book was how terrible most people are with cell phones and how annoying and how they are talking into them too loudly and telling you where they are when you don't care and things like that. And part of what I realized while writing that book was that it's not really fair to harsh on people for being so terrible with cell phones because they're new and we don't really have social protocols for them and we didn't grow up with them, most of us. So I started using this system when I call people up on the phone, on a cell phone, and I the first thing I ask them is this a good time? And if it's not, I say goodbye, or I ask them for when's a good time, and I get off the phone. And then I ask them, sorry, this Twitter thing, I'm going to turn off my phone. Then I ask them, how much time do you have right now? Because if they have 5 minutes, I'll have the 5-minute conversation with them, and if they have 30 minutes, then I'll do that. But if we don't have that kind of level setting at the beginning of the conversation, then they might be kind of looking at the clock and not paying attention and doing their email and stuff like that. And I'd rather know how much of your attention can I have, and let's just use that. Which, again, related to presence in my mind, because I feel like we have all these different modes of being in communication with each other or available to each other or visible to each other, and they all have their own rules. But the ideal, from my perspective, is to sort of maximize your presence, or at least optimize your presence, let's say, through whatever mode is available at the given time. I'm just very quickly going to run through a couple ideas and then throw this out to these things out to the rest of the panel. I'm kind of interested in this place, Places, where you tell people where you are and create this trail of where you've been geographically in the world. I noticed it when I saw that Peter Merholtz's I Am availability status often set a location and sort of had a plug for Places. So I went there looking recently to see if I could grab a slide for this panel, and I see, oh, I can't see where Peter is unless I'm talking to him by IM or whatever, because he's only letting people in the system see it. So I logged in and set up, you know, yet again, had to key in a new identity and a new system and set up a profile. And then suddenly I can see that Peter's been to the airport, he's been to Berkeley and San Francisco, et cetera, et cetera. And I zoomed in on the map, and here's some places he often is. There's the Adaptive Path office, and there's his home in Berkeley, and the place he likes to drink coffee and stuff like that. also, while I was setting up my own settings, I saw that they have this thing called traces, which is the history of where you've been. So you really can be spying on yourself or letting other people spy on you. And they might say, why did you go down to Tijuana? You didn't mention that to me, and that kind of thing. And they have over here on the right, they say, why should I set my visibility options to show to anybody? And I think that's a good question. Let me see. I'm going to skip this one. Here I am on Twitter. I finally gave in last night and signed up for it, and now I have a million messages from Robert Scoble on my phone. And somehow, I guess I was surfing other people and grabbing all their friends who I knew, and I ended up with Borat on my list, apparently. And also this guy Nick, who I'm sure is a really nice guy, but I must have just added him without realizing it. And I think I took him off again. I apologize. Let's see. Okay, just a moment of seriousness for a second. This is a picture of Leslie Harpold, which I know a lot of people here in South by Southwest probably knew better than I knew her. I knew her a little bit. She died last year. She was an amazing, she was before blogging, but she was an amazing web artist. She very successfully projected her identity online. She's a model in some ways from my point of view. When she died, when people discovered that she died because her annual Advent calendar, which was this art project that she would do every year, stopped updating. So people were checking every day and looking for the next day, and it wasn't there, and finally word got out. And there was this incredible outpouring all across the web, blogosphere, and everywhere, and Delicious, with people writing reminiscences and talking about how she had influenced them. And she was a person who was amazing in real life and amazing on the web, and I just thought, I basically just wanted to remember her, publicly. Let's see, a couple other things really quickly. There's this interaction designer who was named David Heller, and he changed his name to David Maloof. He took his wife's last name, and he blogged about the entire name change process. And this is just a kind of a brief list of all the different organizations he had to tell that he was changing his name. It didn't fit on one screen. Whoops. Oh, I guess the show's over. No, it didn't fit on one screen, so I kept scrolling down. And what's interesting is that he blogged this whole process on and on and on. This is a notice he had to stick in the newspaper, so he had to officially tell everybody that he's now this other person, he's the same person, but he has a different name. A number of women wrote in, because women often change their name when they get married, and in appreciation, I guess, for the fact that he was just documenting what a hassle that whole thing is. I thought that was just an interesting little case study. Another thing I stumbled on, I don't know if Karen might be here. She has a Vox. Showed up in my radar at some point. And she told this little story about somebody having let someone else log into their computer to demo personalized search, and then finding out that they'd left it logged in, and so the other person had a whole list of all their searches for the last 3 months or so. And so they got interested in looking at her searches to she said, I don't look at porn or whatever. I'm not worried about people seeing what I've been searching. But right near the top of the list was a search for threesomes. So she found that kind of, it was an object lesson. Another thing real briefly was, I remember at one point coming across this thing, I think it was in Delicious or Flickr or in both or whatever, that Thomas Vanderwall, like seeing his name as a podcast on somebody else's iChat and IMing the guy, and the guy says, well, how do you think it feels for me? I'm listening to this podcast and suddenly I'm talking to you. So that was kind of a strange presence identity crossover moment. Let's see, I was doing my homework and going through all the Delicious links I'd saved in the last year and a half researching my book, and I found the blog post, which I'll show in a moment or two, by, I'm gonna say his name wrong, Jay Winia, about recording your attention and spying on yourself. I'm pretty sure I stole that phrase, spying on yourself, for the description of this panel. My little note to myself is people are gonna end up having a separate computer for browsing porn. Let's see, what else? This is what happens when you try to research yourself at the National Security Agency. And this is something by Nate Keckley, who I work with at Yahoo, who's, again, just an interesting... He was talking about the We Are the Web... the Web 2.0, the machine is us / using us sort of show that was on VideoTube, on YouTube a while ago, and was just talking about attention, but I'm going to try to cut things short here. It was a nice picture. This was the thing about recording your attention, spying on yourself. A mention of attention trust, which some other people are going to address. I like that the Google ads on the left side include cheating spouse, So somehow there's an inference there. I'm just going to try to copy Peter Merholtz and put a picture of an iPod up on the screen for a second. And I just, once again, I want to remind people that it's people! Okay, so... I believe that next is Kalia.
Actually, can I just jump in and say I am Peter, and even though his presence message, sounds really loud up here. I am Peter, and his presence message says South by Southwest, but he says he's really sorry he can't join us at the conference because he stayed out too late.
Okay. I think we have to do
We have to do a switch.
We have to do some AV magic. Where's this slideshow?
It's under view.
Wait.
It's too early.
Oh, yeah. I just did that opening slide. So, I actually wanted to see how technical the audience was before I did my spiel on identity. So how many of you have heard of OpenID? Ooh, okay. That's good. And how many of you are programmers? Okay. And designer, usability, make it work kind of people. Okay, good. Well, that's great. So, this is a slide from a colleague in the community, Johannes Ernst, and basically this is the issue, right? Namespaces are going crazy. Everybody's twittering about Twitter, and I go there and I'm like, God, not another name and password. This is awful. And it's still an issue. You know, this is the problem we were trying to solve a year ago. And email's even more broken than ever. So, you know, how do we solve this? And you've got the user-centric paradigm that we put out, which is like, instead of us getting our identities and having a different username and password everywhere we go, we should be at the center, and we should tell the people and the organizations and the websites we go to who we are. So we worked really hard. Oops. Sorry. I'll just kill this. So we worked really hard to bring you OpenID, and it's a long process, but basically the Six Apart OpenID guys, the iNames folks and the LID people all got together and said, you know, if we go to market and we try to convince all of you to implement our thing and not their thing, you'll have to implement like three different login boxes with three different, this is insane. We should just stop the competition now and all cooperate and let you guys put one box on your site that works with all of our different identifiers. So that was the deal that was made, and why OpenID 2 is a little bit more complex than some people like, but it also solved a problem of not bringing you all this crazy competition. And so behind the Yadis protocol is an XML document that tells you the service types that are available from that identifier, whether it's a URL or an iName. And right now, the most obvious thing to do is single sign-on. Skip actually joined the party this summer, and so it's all together, these four different sort of user-centric approaches that were all very similar are cooperating. And together, now we have OpenID version 2 that's getting widespread adoption, where you just put the login box on your website, you adjust your user tables, and now you can accept, you know, set these identifiers from people. So there's a lot of folks playing in this game. Big players, little players. How many of you actually have OpenID? You accept OpenIDs? Yes! So great. And it really just looks like this from a user experience point of view. So how does it work? I'm this person. I want to go log into a WordPress blog. We call that a relying party. And I give them my identifier. My name is equals Kalia. And it redirects me to where my identifier lives, my iBroker or my OpenID provider. And it says, hey, Kalia, is that you? And I go, yeah, this is my password. And then it redirects me back to where I was logging in. And the redirection is really critical because you need to give your password to your OpenID provider, not to the relying party, because then they have the keys to get into your website. So this is an adjustment in sort of user experience that now it's our job to communicate to users using this that that's the proper behavior. You don't want to give your password to a relying party. So I want to go to a different relying party, WikiTravel. They're in the audience. And I give them my identifier, and they check with my iBroker, and they're like, she's already logged in, and they just redirect me back. So what this does is it builds an authentication layer on the web, and it's really, really lightweight. It doesn't do a whole lot, but it allows for new things to get built on top of it that weren't possible before. And this is a sort of vision of where things are going in the future. There's many other pieces to the identity puzzle that are more complex in some ways, but that you would have an open standards and largely open source set of tools that would be this identity layer on the web that was free, but then on top of it are reputation, verification, and other services that some of these folks will be talking about the potential for those. But OpenID is simple because it allows complexity to emerge over time, and we wanted to get adoption of that simple layer as opposed to packing a lot into it so that it was harder to get adoption. So that's what I have to say.
So next up is Ted, and we need to switch back to the other.
Is it one? Which one is it?
I think it was whatever I was just on.
We don't know.
Okay. One, maybe?
Yes.
All right. So my name is Ted Nadeau, and I'm going to be speaking on reputation, which I'm excited about because prior to being given the assignment, I didn't know much about it. So I'm speaking as one of you just starting out thinking about reputation, unless you happen to be one of the very limited number of people who have built a reputation management system, which I think there are not that many of. So I don't give a damn about my bad reputation. Apologies to Joan Jett. But we are a new generation, and we do need to manage and think about reputation in a whole entirely different way than, and new tool sets, new exposure than we ever have had to in the past. The small town that we used to live in is now potentially internet scale, and so your reputation, your identity is all exposed to the earth, and that's kind of inevitable, and though you can be pro-privacy, as all of us are, it's a fighting, losing battle. You'll get certain amounts of privacy, but ever increasingly, people will know more and more and more about you. So you start looking at your reputation. What is it? What is reputation 2.0? Where is it stored? Reputation, and this panel is talking about non-monetary assets, your identity, attention, influence, your reputation. And of course, for those of you childhood geeks, your strength, intelligence, wisdom, constitution, dexterity, charisma, and other experience, which are important characteristics for you to know. These are ever-increasingly important non-monetary assets, not just how much money you have, but the degree to which you have these other assets. Where are they stored? Who knows them? Who do you reveal to that you are have a strong constitution or don't have a strong constitution? So who am I? With apologies to the identity movement, I have a certain identity, and then I appear as different things to different people. Some parts of my identity are asserted by me, some are asserted by other individuals. There's groups that have an agreement about who I am, and there's sometimes I disagree with the group, and there's an agreement between me and the group, or not. It's complicated. So here's my identity. Princeton, consulting, attention economy, money transfer, imaging and workflow, Boston Computer Exchange, 84. Your reputation, how is it related to identity? It's part of your identity. It's connected to your identity. It appears different to different viewers. I like to think that identity is the holistic thing that you truly are, you know, with apologies to the concept of truth, but that you have various appearances that are varying degrees of accurate, varying degrees of shared. But the interesting thing about reputation is you're not currently the primary authority of your reputation. You're the last person to ask. Other people know about your reputation in a way that's different than what you would say about your reputation. It might be nice to be able to know what other people think your reputation is. So what's my own reputation? Well, none of you know me yet. Actually, my wife is in the audience. She knows me. So Christian picked me.
Or does she?
And what is this talk and what is this not, this talk? This is just a quick sketch, quick survey. It's not deep analysis. It's not academic research. There's going to be no formulas in this thing. I was tempted and interested, but I couldn't get into it, and maybe it's not appropriate for this audience anyway. So if you research reputation in Wikipedia, of course, good place to start, or you Google it, you got 173 million pages, dictionary. Delicious, this is an interesting thing. There's 5,600 entries in Delicious, but the top link only has 316. It's not a very deeply analyzed, built-out domain set yet. It's open for grabs. Somebody can do it in this audience. reputation systems, reputation management, services, repositories, standards. What do you find when you get a little more deeper? You find things like eigentrust. You're summarizing reputation to a single number. What degree can I trust this resource in giving me this piece of information? I need a number between 0 and 1. You might read a science fiction short story by Cory Doctorow about Wuffy, where it's a post-monetary economy and everybody just lives for the amount of reputation that they get by doing good deeds or not doing good deeds. You lose, you gain Wuffy. I didn't read it. I was too busy. I apologize. It's probably good. It's on my list. there's this concept of karma, borrowed from various religious practices, and Slashdot, which has a concept of karma, and then iKarma and KarmaSphere. So I looked at iKarma. I'm like, well, I shouldn't be giving a talk without really looking into iKarma, and apologies to potentially anybody who's at iKarma, but when I look there, the stock price is only 1 cent, down from 33 cents. So we could pool together $1.40 and probably buy it before we leave this room if we all decide that that's a good thing to do. Apinity, which I think I'm spelling correctly. That's kind of interesting to me. They, at least, I haven't played with it enough to really figure out to what degree it's working or not working, but I do have a login there, so maybe one thing at the end of this thing is you can all get your own logins at Apinity and give your opinions about me. All right, so the status of reputation is none of them are compelling. Reputation 1.0 is not working as a standalone destination or service. There's no transfers between of your reputation between different websites. There's no consistency. There are conceptual models. There's lots of academic papers. There's, you know, buildings of academics, you know, working on this thing, but nobody's coding it yet. So what is reputation? Well, here's perhaps, this is from Wikipedia, but hyper reformatted by me. The general opinion, it's a judgment of and by the public or an individual towards an entity, which they spell out as a person, group, or people, blah, blah, blah. And it's, I think it's important to say that it's different and distinct from just what everybody has. You know, instead of like, we're all have arms, except for the people who don't have arms. You know, that's not a really important reputation thing. But somebody who's like scary when they're drunk, that's good to know, because, you know, they're, that's not something that everybody else is. They have a reputation for that. Okay. And another thing that's super important about this whole reputation thing is this social control concept. Now, not social control, puppet master, but social control, like you need to create a methodology for people to behave appropriately in various different social settings. So we have shame, we have reputation, we have karma, we have lots of different systems. Reputation is the human meat space way that we've been thinking about this as normal human beings. And so if we can duplicate some of the stuff that we have in society about reputation in a system, then that was probably a good idea. So some examples. Hagrid has a reputation as a mean drunk, which is a context. You know, like only when he's drunk he's mean. Generally he's a completely great guy. AT&T had a reputation for innovation. This is a reputation can be lost. South by Southwest has a reputation by keeping it weird yet relevant. And Fox News, whatever. Okay. Some things have big reputations. Unlike identity, where we all have maybe the same amount of identity, we all have the same number of names approximately. Reputation is orders of magnitude. You know, a corporation's reputation is, you know, worth, you know, billions of dollars or something like that to them. So that's, you know, a different architecture needs to handle the fact that reputations have different scales. I was trying to think of who has big reputation. I was like, the World Wrestling Federation. You really know, you know, Skyler or Doofus or whatever the name of any of these people, how they're going to behave, and they fight out these archetypical battles, and it's good against evil, and it's the one who always cheats. That guy always cheats. And so in society we had also, and some of us still do, polytheistic gods. You know how Zeus is going to behave when Hera comes home and is jealous about the, you know, or soap operas, you know, are filled with sort of reputational systems because it's something you see reoccurringly. You know how this person is generally going to behave. It's consistent. Other reputations, the U.S., the world is now hostile to the U.S., news organizations, journalists, politicians, the internet itself. What is the reputation of the internet? So there's lots of online systems that, as part of their existing system, have built in a sort of reputation system. There's the famous eBay reputation, where, apologies to Garrison Keillor and somebody else who wrote it, everybody is above average. Everybody has above average reputation, because the system that they built, you know, pretty much you only give somebody credit if they do a good thing, and there's lots of back, you know, log rolling or mutual back scratching, so there's no zero sum. It's not very discerning as a terms of a reputation system. But it, you know, it works for generic transactions. Somebody with no reputation, you don't trust them as much as somebody who has a reputation. Somebody who has a big reputation, then it starts to get a little sketchy because maybe they're cheating. Maybe they've done 10,000 little snuffy dog sales and now they're trying to sell you a painting that's, you know, allegedly made by Picasso, but it's not by Picasso. So, World of Warcraft, Amazon, all of these things have reputation systems, but I'm going forward fast. Pre-internet, Scarlet Letter, FICO scores, D&B reports, diamond grading. Just as in any system, we need degree comparisons. We need measurements of truth. Some usage cases, how do you pick a doctor? How do you pick a movie? How do you pick a restaurant in a foreign country? How do you hire a consultant? What would the perfect reputation system be like? Well, so I think one thing that we're starting to see with identity and other things is the idea of different data stores. I have my own copy of my reputation judgments of other individuals. You have your own copy. It doesn't need to be shared. Ideally, I should be able to move my reputation from one repository to another repository. I keep my bits on this hard drive or this hard drive or this hard drive, any of various different service providers. There's also agreement. Sometimes it's agreed and sometimes it's not agreed, and ideally it would resolve conflicts. It would increase agreement. It would increase truth. And it would recognize that there's multiple views. Sometimes, you know, as long as this person has a generally an okay reputation, it's fine for me to get a ride with them. Or, you know, if there's any black mark on this brain surgeon, then I don't want to deal with them. You know, like, so you have different thresholds and different systems that you would want. It's not going to be an eigentrust for reputation. There's not going to be a single number from 0 to 1. Problems? What problems? Well, reputation theft, of course, is part of your identity. Reputation damage, loss, being stuck. So Zay Frank had a little piece the other day which said that, you know, your family does, you know, knows who you are, and it's impossible to be different with your family. It's very, very hard. But if you're part of a bowling league, you can sort of try out a new being in your bowling league. And so maybe, you know, the internet's good for this. In World of Warcraft, I'm really tough. Whereas at home, I'm not. So a good reputation system should allow people to be mobile and move their identity, you know, in one way or another instead of just being stuck in a caste, you know, STE, you know, at a certain place when you first arrive. So we need to handle identity first before we can really get into reputation at all. There's this thing about Sybil attacks, you know, because a user ID is not a person. People could have 50 user IDs. You can get a bad reputation from 50 users who are really all the same person, that damn ex-boyfriend or girlfriend. And of course, Slashdot has taught us some preliminary things about karma whoring. Oh, I'm just going to say something that's generally like kind of obvious that everybody kind of wants me to say, and that'll boost my reputation. But that's just because it's an early generation of reputation systems. So, call to action, next steps. Deepen the conversation. Implement reputation systems. Contact Christian or me via his blog. I don't have a blog. Contact me to start a company.
Proxy.
So, think about your reputation. What is it? Where is it? That's it.
Deep breath. Okay, Mary, you're up. So we need to switch. Are you not doing slides?
I don't have a slide.
Yeah, no slides.
I'm absolutely amazed that you can be funny at this point in the morning.
The East Coast.
So, like, oh my God!
Flash gang sign.
And with the time change. When we originally talked about doing this panel, I think it was like at 5 o'clock, you know, much more sane. So Christian asked me to talk about attention, and earlier we were talking about our views of attention because he's also worked with the attention trust and root markets and whatnot, and had a much more academic view of attention. And so I'm actually going to just share a little bit of that, but then explain what I think about around attention. So my background is as a usability engineer. That's my training. And so I tend to think about these things from a user perspective, and to not necessarily discuss them in the geekiest of terms necessarily, because I think it's easier to understand if you can relate things to yourself first and then think about building them for everybody else if you're a coder or a builder. So anyway, what we were discussing earlier was about how Michael Goldhaber, who is a professor, had at one point written up and sort of quantified in hard terms what he felt the attention economy and attention generally was. I find that stuff interesting, but I don't think it's that important necessarily. If you're really into it, Google him, and his papers and writings are online. More recently, he did this, I think, in the early 90s. Root Markets, Seth Goldstein, who started Root Markets, and a group of people also formed a nonprofit called the Attention Trust, and I'm on that board. And we started thinking about attention in quantifiable ways, ways that would make it more conscious. For years, we've all been using the internet or using systems like the ones that everybody here has sort of talked about. excuse me. And those systems collect gestures or data about us, right? And we don't really think too much about it. If you're on AIM, you're just, you know, IMing your friends, and you don't really think much about what that means or who's collecting that information or whatever. And you think, well, maybe AOL is collecting that information, but what are they going to do with it? What does it mean beyond, you know, the individual detritus of your life and the other person's who you're IMing with? You just don't spend a lot of time thinking about it, and then to take it up a level, you know, when you search at Google, you don't really think too much about it. You just do your searches, and maybe somewhere in the back of your minds, you know that Google is collecting that information and they're feeding it into their search and PageRank system, and they're creating better search with it. But again, what are they doing with it? They're probably not selling it because they want to keep that data in-house, but nonetheless, you know they're using it, but it doesn't seem that consequential, but actually it's incredibly consequential. It's the basis for their entire business model. And so there's an attention economy that is very lucrative that gets built on all those gestures or things that we do. So to explain the concept of a gesture, if I build a web page or a blog or something and I link to somebody, the link is a gesture. And Google spiders the web, and they take that link and they say, that's a vote of confidence. That means something. And so when they build PageRank, they build it around the concept of all of these links pointing all over the web, and they then rank the search results based on that and the clicks that people select as they, you know, the web pages that people select as they get back search results. And it's the combination of those two things that creates the basis for their search pages. And then, of course, AdSense is also based on all of this. So it has a huge consequence for the company, and obviously they've made a ton of money, you know, using this data. And so the Attention Trust asserts that you own a copy of this information. And actually, when we started the Attention Trust almost 2 years ago, we kind of assumed that it was going to be this giant fight to try to get all of the companies, Amazon, you know, the bigger companies that are making money from some, you know, slice of your attention information, to agree that you owned a copy of your information. But the folks that started the Attention Trust, in particular Seth Goldstein and Steve Gilmore, sort of very strategically went around to these different companies, Amazon, Google, and sometimes they did it publicly. They approached some of the Google folks at PC Forum, which is was a big conference, from the audience, and in other cases they went in and sort of had private meetings and basically got everybody to agree that, yeah, the users own a copy of their attention streams. What's your attention stream? That's all those clicks that you make when you're surfing around those websites, whether it's all the Google sites or it's Amazon and you're buying things or it's, you know, wherever. And so anyway, in the meantime, the Attention Trust also built a recorder so that you could record what you had done and share that if you wanted to in an anonymous way and put that attention stream into a pool. And I think that pool has very interesting consequences for the democracy and things that we do. It's extremely valuable data, as I said, to Google to keep that information private, or Microsoft for MSN for their search and other products and companies that can collect a huge amount of data. The reason why I think it has really interesting consequences for the democracy, and why I might disagree that you would want to keep your porn surfing habits private or on another computer or maybe just in another browser, is because in the context of the attention recorder, if you decide to use it, you're actually passing along the information privately, in a way. It's anonymized. And the value of passing along everything that you do is this. Just to take things back for a second, in the 50s, there was this guy named McCarthy, and he ran around and harassed people because he said that they were un-American, and he dragged them in front of Congress and would get them, you know, thrown out of their jobs and essentially make them unemployable. And he did that by creating this pervasive sense across our society at the time that people who weren't American, whatever that meant at the time, were bad, and therefore they should be shunned in some way, not employed, not paid, not, you know, maybe they had to leave the country, whatever. And he did that because he said that particular behaviors were not common, and because they weren't common, they were outside of the norm. And this concept of social norms is, I think, really important. When we surf online, wherever we surf, whether we go to porn sites or we go anywhere else, we're downloading music, we're engaging in social norms. And if the government can subpoena Microsoft and Google and Yahoo for our click streams, our attention data, and then claim that whatever it is that we're doing for the subsections of people that engage in, you know, file sharing or whatever it is that, you know, the government's trying to go after people for, then what they're doing is they're basically segmenting a section of the population away from the rest of everybody else, and they're saying these people are normal and this subsection is not normal. And if the only people that have that attention data are the Yahoos, Googles, and Microsofts of the world, right? The giant pool that would show that the social norms are actually much more pervasive across all of these different behaviors. If that attention pool is secret, then it means that the government can pull off these claims. They can say, yeah, you downloaded some, you know, songs, so we're throwing you in jail. But if all of our attention information is actually public but anonymized, it's very difficult for the government to make that claim. And so I'm actually an advocate for anonymously sharing everything that you do, because it makes it very hard for the government to make those kinds of claims. And I actually think that entertainment companies, legacy media companies, want to be able to get a small section of the population demonized for engaging in behaviors that we know culturally on the web is actually very normal and should be encouraged. Sharing is a good thing. And it leads to some of the other things that people here were talking about around reputation and good activities. Sharing things is actually a great thing, because attention can be turned back into monetizable events as well as good other things that we can do. So anyway, that's my interest in attention. That's why I agreed to be on the Attention Trust, because I think that it's very important both that individuals, users, own a copy of their information, but also because I think it's really good for the democracy to take what has been a very unconscious thing under the surface, attention data. It sounds incredibly geeky and something that these companies just sort of do under the hood and in the background, and makes it conscious for us. And we start to think about what we're doing and how those companies use that information. I would give one last example. San Francisco, along with many other municipalities, is looking at putting in a free wireless system. And recently, the RFP and the answers to the RFP came to light. And Google and Earthlink have proposed that they will pay the $9 million to get Google or San Francisco completely wired up. And that sounds like an incredibly great deal for the city, right? Wonderful. Let's do it. But in exchange for that, they get everyone's attention data for 17 years, which is like enormous. That's like, in my own estimation, is that like a minimum of $1 billion of attention data for Google to have. And that the city should actually really be compensated for that. They should pay the city maybe 10% of that or something over a 17-year period. But they're not. They would just plunk down the $9 million to get everybody wired up. They would have no obligation to increase the hardware or value of the system over the 17 years, and they would basically own it and own all of our data. And so I think it's a really important thing to make conscious in our world, because our cities, our municipalities, in our own actions and behaviors, we're agreeing to things that I think we just don't really understand or are not aware of. So anyway. What's that?
You're up. My name's George Kelly. I blog at All About George, negrophile.com, blipster.info, allaboutgeorge.vox.com, and a few other places. Thank you for coming out this morning. I'm going to keep things brief. I'm borrowing Kalia's laptop to point to one of the more interesting things I found a couple of years ago online through my friends, this interactive Johari window. And you can see that it was developed as a map of a way to model personality awareness. I'm going to scroll down to the bottom. You're able to start by choosing five or six words that best describe you from a list below, and the results will be saved. I'll enter my unique name so you can see what I put about myself. Oh, snap. I'll just put them in.
Can you browse back to the old results?
That's what I'm going to do. That's what I'm going to do.
Google.
some reason I didn't consider myself modest. And it looks like there's a bunch of stuff I did not know about myself or that other people who visited the site seemed to think about me. If I were intelligent, I wouldn't be borrowing Kalia's laptop to show you this. And then at the bottom, there are the items that are, you know, there are known knowns and there are unknown knowns. A great philosopher said that once, I think. And then there's the flip side of it. I've got failings. Other people tell me so. That's how I know.
Whoa. Who's hating on you?
So other people went in and clicked on those things and said, that's you?
Freddie Johnson said, I know I've got a bad reputation, and it isn't just talk, talk, talk.
Well, I mean, how many people went in and did that? I'm just curious. This is fascinating.
Well, he asked us to.
29 people.
Here are my friends, or my critics.
This is like Jite on steroids.
You get a site like this, and who needs Google? This is the data stream I'm interested in. Obviously, you've got someone named Lamb Bam Bo Bam and Lamb Chop and Lamb Lay and Lammy Pie, and perhaps I can filter those out because that looks kind of sibilish to me. At my very first South by Southwest, I attended a panel that talked about conceptual firewalls, and I was struck by what one of the panelists in particular had to say. Her name was Anna Cisnet, and she works here in Austin, on Austin Freenet. And she talked about cultural barriers that come with issues surrounding blogging and disclosure of information, you know. You don't necessarily want to create a blog and wind up having it become allupinyourbusiness.com. Unless, you know, you're finding a way to monetize that now that we have the technology. She said that, you know, there are these implications for putting your information out there and that that could be a barrier for some communities. And I got a real sense of that yesterday when I attended two panels in particular, World Domination via Collaboration, where I was particularly struck by Jenna Whittle's comment that if you don't have a persistent identity, you don't get the benefits of community. You can also get the flip side of, you know, the downside of community, but it's a risk. You get a risk. You take risks just getting up out of bed, not to mention turning the computer on. If you want to find out more about these folks' perspectives, you find these panelists while you're here, you know, in this meat space. Make good use of it. I'll leave it at that for now.
So we do have about 5 minutes officially, and we started a little late. So if anybody has questions, please, you need to go to the standalone mic.
Good morning. I'm David Swedlow, a Opposable Mind, and this intersection of these four topics is about as passionate as a combination of topics that I can see. The intersection of them is kind of left as an exercise to the listener. And I'd like to know, you know, if there's any place where this kind of conversation is taking place currently, I'd like to point to that. If not, Opposable Mind, I'd like to propose that as a place to get started, to point some places. Because I think this is a very important topic in the intersection of these things is critical.
Great.
So if y'all have comments about places where some of the intersection of these parts is taking place. I'd like to hear about that.
So, well, I'll start. The Internet Identity Workshop is a place where all the big players and all the little players are coming, and we're getting more and more into the social implications and identity rights agreements, and can we, you know, bootstrap some norms about how these identities are used and how people are exchanging them, and that whole range of issues now that we actually have a technical layer that could do some of this stuff. So that's up there. It's May 14 to 16 in Mountain View, and the website is the bottom URL, iiw.winley.com. So that's one place for sure.
There's also going to be the Identity Open Space Workshop in Brussels on April 26th to 27th. I think you can find more about that at events.projectliberty.org.
Yeah, I'm running
that. This doesn't help anyone, but starting tonight in New York City, there's this evening and tomorrow, there's an attention conference that is being held. But since it doesn't really help anyone, I would say go to attentiontrust.org. And, you know, periodically there'll be an attention event somewhere, either, it generally tends to be East Coast or West Coast, so it doesn't help people in the middle. But, on the other hand, if you're really interested, join and start your own. It's a very open organization.
My name is Lizzie Burr, and two people in the panel knew me as Liz Burr, a previous identity, and I can vouch that Ted Nadeau is not a mean drunk. I wanted to ask you all about the concept that of a single reputation, because I am pretty convinced that none of us would think that we have a single reputation in our wet world lives. And I am concerned about the inability. I've closed down my blog because I'm sick of developing a single reputation. I have multiple things I've blogged about over time. I used to be prematurely gray, and then I colored my hair, and then I stopped coloring my hair. I think that that's a real issue here, that we develop these ideas of a single repository where all of this goes, and that is a change in the idea of self in the society. So if you have any thoughts on that, technically as well, how we can keep things multivalent.
Well, I mean, I don't know. You know, I think the idea, for instance, of a blog as a way of projecting and communicating your identity is very powerful. But then there's that point that, as you say, there starts to be this one central page or stream that Google points everybody to when they look you up. And, you know, if you Google my name, you find actually the first result is a blog that I don't really write for very much anymore, but it was the one that got the most incoming links, etc. And my own solution, which drove me insane eventually, was to have a lot of different blogs, each on a different topic. But that just is such a pain. And then people complain that they can't find where I wrote something recently, etc. So now I'm kind of merging them all back together. But that's no answer either. So, you know, no, I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah, I don't know the answer either, but I would say that I have not been able to project any sort of consistent identity onto the web because of the roles that I've had in various different companies where I'm very much like in the company and doing the thing that the company wants, and it's not really me, but it's what I do for a living in the company. And so I think one answer is you can hope to integrate your presentation in terms of your identity going forward as something to sort of strive for. And I think that generationally, youth is a little more intuitively able to see that I'm not two different people. These are just two different broadcast avenues, and not get confused or concerned about the fact that, you know, my blog says, you know, I'm a this, and my other thing says I'm a this, and some people get confused. So, I think there's really a question of both identity and maintaining and coalescing a integrated identity, and then how that reflects on your reputation as a portion of your identity, I think, is what you're getting at.
I would also add, it's really unfortunate that the interfaces are so bad online, especially at Google, with, you know, taking the gesture of the link and having no sense of time, that there's no statute of limitations on the importance of information. We do this in our lives. I mean, you mentioned coloring your hair and the not coloring your hair. We have mechanisms in our brains that when we see things in, and you are an interface out to the world, right? And you project a certain look, and people are able to gauge, you know, how you are. And if they remember something that you did 20 years ago, they discount it because it was 20 years ago. But we can't
let's
do that
so.
Online. What?
Said, let's hope so.
Well, or maybe they don't. But the point is that there's real world ways for us to age out information, and we don't do that very well online.
Yeah.
And I think it's not actually all of our individual faults. It's the responsibility of people who build systems, and I'm just as much at fault for doing this. I mean, when you build a live web search system, you're factoring in time, and it supposedly will help with this, but I don't think we're any closer to fixing the interface problem that you're talking about.
And I'll chime in and say, I think that people in this room have a unique opportunity to help with this problem. There's an issue in identity about how we identify ourselves to others and how we express ourselves and all that information. And the physical world has certain properties about how it operates. And then you translate into the logical world. And all of a sudden, things that in the physical world have a lot of friction have zero friction. And that's where I think a lot of the weirdness about identity online starts to happen, is because we haven't replicated a lot of the friction in how we interact in the physical world about identity and the range of how we express ourselves into the digital world. So if you guys can work on increasing identity friction, I think it'll help make it be more successful in the long run about how we move all this stuff around and not just end up with one repository of everything about me, but more of a mapping about how we're used to expressing this stuff in the physical world.
And actually, there's one other thing, too, which Kalia, you know, when she showed those slides of the way that identity works, it was with a single identity, as if I inhabit one identity. And, you know, I have multiple reputations, and it's actually a real mistake to take one reputation out of one context and move it to another. And we do this in our real lives. Like, I don't wear my bathrobe to work unless I have my startup in my house. And I don't wear my work clothes to bed. And it's because, you know, my boyfriend wouldn't like that. You know, I mean, and that's like a physical representation of mixing reputation. But the point is that, that online, we still have this concept that's very weird about just mixing everything up. And so, like, why is it okay for Opinity to take my eBay reputation, which only makes sense in the context of that community, out somewhere else? And it just doesn't make sense. And so, the thing that I would say is, you know, think about having multiple identities and using the system that Kalia represented in one slide with one identity. You know, think about having, like, your different reputations. Instead of having 250 logins for the 250 websites you use, have 4 logins and then use them where you want to use them, which more mimics the way we are in our real lives. We present ourselves, a slice of ourselves in different situations.
We call those personas.
As they're appropriate. So, anyway.
Okay. I'm Jean Davis, and I'm an author, and I wanted to address this to you, Ted Mandel. How do you see the combination or coming together of reputation online and platform?
And what?
Platform in writing and for authors and news is creating that ambience, that presence, and the coming together between reputation and platform.
Thanks for asking the question. I think that I'm only at the sort of infancy. I mean, last night at 10 p.m. was when I did most of my work. well, not completely true, but interleaved in the last week. So I wouldn't say that my vocabulary or thoughts regarding reputation and platform, you know, would coalesce, but just a sort of quick ad lib is, you know, people grow reputation. The systems that I'm looking at are a sort of, primarily I'm a programmer, so I really want to think about, like, how would you implement this system? But switching away from that, how would a user reflect that system? I think that the quick answer would be, well, you start with what would you want your reputation to be. You make a declaration about the reputation that you would like to have, and then you monitor and measure through however people are showing or seeing that reputation. And then a platform, stage, internet presence, you know, the internet is a place to be and express yourself. So, you know, I think that would be sort of the simplest starting place. You know, make a web page, you know, have it be your platform, say what reputation you would like it to have, say, if my reputation is not this, contact me, you know, because I'd like to adjust my reputation. And, you know, sort of start with that. That's not a sort of systems method, but it's a feedback method.
You can register IamNotAMeanDrunk.com.
Right. Right.
That sounds so okay, defensive.
Well, we're supposed to wrap it up now because we got to let people filter in and out for the next session. So,
well, I want to hear this last question. She's
yeah.
been standing.
Yeah, I'd like to do that too. Thanks. Okay.
Okay. Thank you. My name's Deanna Zan. I work for Alternet and for Jim Hightower and a bunch of other people. Well, one of the things that we're...
Yay, thanks.
Yeah.
One of the things, it seems like we're largely talking about the identities that we're putting out there in different ways, but I'm interested to hear some thoughts about what people are putting out there about me or others are putting out about others. There was this article, I think it was in the Washington Post, but it might have been the Times, New York Times, about law firms Googling potential candidates and then not hiring them because of what's been said about them. And I have a friend who's a feminist blogger at a blog called Feminist, Jill, who her picture was put up on one of these sites. She's a fairly attractive woman, and these largely, you know, male audience, you know, kind of graded her. And she's very fearful now that, you know, a potential law firm is going to look at this and think that she's some kind of, like, you know, internet slut, you know, and so, you know, she contacted the guys that had that ran the site, and they were like, nope, sorry, you're out there in the world. There's nothing you can do about this. So some thoughts about that kind of situation would be great.
I think that's extremely unfortunate. In Dabbl, we collect, you know, we index videos all across the web, and this morning I was answering feedback email from somebody who had someone else put up a video of them that was unflattering. He's a law school student, and he was playing Tetris in the middle of a lecture, and someone shot video from behind him of him playing, and then put it up on YouTube, and then put his name on it. And he wanted it removed from Dabbl. And, you know, I think that's actually the right thing to do, is to... He didn't want that up there, and maybe wasn't doing the right thing, but who are we to say... You're out there in the world. I mean, he was in law school class, you know. I mean, I don't know. I think that's a really unfortunate response. But, and those people kind of made the site owners really made the wrong decision in that case.
I think, too, that there's a certain amount of literacy we're going to gain around, like, oh, well, that's their personal life, and I'm going to ignore it because it's improper for me to make judgments about this thing that I'm hiring them for because that's over there. And that, you know, if people can't make those discernments, they're going to lose good people, right? And that people, like the website not wanting to take down that website itself is going to end up with a bad reputation for not responding to people in a proper way. Like, I think all the norms of you know, how we create social norms apply still, right? Like, something bad happens to me. Now in email, I blog it. I'm like, this person from this company solicited me in this way, and I didn't like it. And we didn't have that personal platform to out bad behavior that we do now with...
Right, and we're kind of in a Wild West phase, and it's sort of frustrating because you're waiting for that maturity to come, and in the meantime, people do get victimized. They're really giving us the frantic. Okay. We got to wrap it up.
Bye.
You know, obviously this is a conversation that needs to continue.
Thanks for all coming out really early.